I would invite you to take a Bible and turn with me to the 85th Psalm as we read verses 8 through 13. In the Pew Bible, it's on page 512. Psalm 85, 8 through 13, as we think about promises. Promises. Let me hear what God the Lord will speak, for he will speak peace to his people, to his faithful, and to those who turn to him in their hearts. Surely his salvation is at hand for those who fear him, that his glory may dwell in our land. Steadfast love and faithfulness will meet. Righteousness and peace will kiss each other. Faithfulness will spring up from the ground, and righteousness will look down from the sky. The Lord will give what is good, and our land will yield its increase. Righteousness will go before him and will make a path for his steps. I can hear it now. Do you promise? Yes, I promise. No crosses of any kind. No crosses of any kind. But I can't see if your ankles are crossed under that wedding gown. You thought I was going to describe children making promises to each other, right? But you know, that is really true. You can't tell whether the bride's got her legs crossed under, her ankles crossed under there or not. Yeah, but we make all kinds of promises in our lives. And many intend to keep some of them. By the way, a promise was made a few weeks ago that A, there would be playground mulch for the playground prior to VBS, and B, that mulch would be in the playground prior to VBS. Thank you for keeping the promise. Those who got the playground mulch here and those who put the playground mulch in, it looks a whole lot better. And I'll bet that if someone falls, it'll feel better than the hard ground that was there prior to the mulch. But we make all kinds of promises, and many people intend to keep some of them. Yet our world is filled with broken promises, is it not? Promises that are left unmade, and even promises that are intended to deceive. So the question comes about, what value does a promise really have today anyway? Also, from where do we even get the audacity to make a promise, much less the strength to keep a promise that we make? And no, the thought did cross my mind, but I don't want to try and sound like Dionne Warwick this morning and sing promises, promises. The biblical text as a whole is filled with promises from God, is it not? Just a short time ago with the children, we read a promise which found in Hebrews chapter 13 actually is a quote from Deuteronomy. But it's filled with promises from God. Promises which God has made and promises that he has continued to keep throughout history, even when sometimes those with whom he made the promise broke their end of the bargain. Now, while Christians understand that God's fulfillment of his promise of salvation and redemption, which he makes throughout the scriptures, is found in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. It's found in Jesus' promise to be with you even to the end. It's also found in that profound statement by God to Moses when God says, tell them Yahweh has sent me. It's there as well. Now, while we generally translate this sacred name as I am, it also means I am who I am what I am, I will be what I will be. Some suggest that it might also be understood as, and I quote here, I am he who will be there with you always. End of quote. One writer states, and I quote, in so many ways, the promises you and I make today are but echoes of the promise of God, the one Yahweh who made those promises to Moses. When we marry one another, we say, I am she who will be with you for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health. When we conceive a child, we say, I am he who will be there with you, little one, until the day death parts us. Excuse me. When we become true friends with another, we say, I am she or he who will be there with you through addiction and alcoholism, through love and loss, through your best days and your worst. At their core, our relationships are all built upon promises. And our promises are ultimately built upon the promise of God. End quote. Now, in the opening verses today of this particular psalm, the psalmist reflects on God's faithfulness in the past. The word of promise to be with his people. The word of promise to forgive the truly penitent, which he continued to keep over and over and over again throughout Israel's history. The faithfulness of God in keeping his promises, despite Israel's lack of fidelity, gives the psalmist a certainty of hope, but not hope in himself, a certainty of hope in God and in a relationship with God. Since most Old Testament scholars consider this particular psalm a liturgical psalm used in worship, the priest or another worship leader would issue the call to the congregants, draw near, remember. And in remembering, rekindle hope in the promises of God. As the individual voice rings out over the congregation in the use of this psalm, the people are called to hear what God, what the Lord Yahweh, will speak to his people, peace and salvation. Peace. And salvation. What a wonderful word of promise, is it not? But this peace and salvation is predicated upon one's conscious and righteous relationship with God. It's not something that comes in and of itself if we do not have that conscious relationship with God. There will be no restoration. In fact, throughout the Hebrew Scriptures, we find that there will be no restoration except to those who acknowledge themselves to be God's people. To those whose lives are His saintliness. To those who turn from their foolish trust in themselves to even more trust in God. The prayer for restoration has been uttered earlier. Lord, you were favorable to your land. You restored the fortunes of Jacob. You forgave the iniquity of your people. You pardoned all their sin. You withdrew all your wrath. You turned from your hot anger. Therefore, restore us again, O God of salvation, and put away your indignation toward us. Verses 1 through 4. But its answer will only be found and heard ringing true by the deserving. Now, you might say, wait a minute, the deserving, I didn't think anyone was deserving. And that's true in and of ourselves. But the psalmist here is relating a concept that runs throughout the Scriptures, a concept of the deserving as those who actually turn their hearts to God and live the relationship before God and others. Only when we turn our hearts to God and then live it, then are we considered the deserving. That's our part. God does His part, but He expects us to act responsibly and to keep our promise to Him. Salvation is available. However, the psalmist indicates, as do many others throughout the Scriptures, salvation is available to all but only those who fear or reverence God appropriately will have it. Now, this salvation, though, is not just so we can have our get-out-of-jail-free card. The psalmist states that this salvation is for the glory of the Lord to dwell, that is, to be alive within the land and to emanate from God's glory in the temple, the house of worship. That salvation is to emanate from this place of worship. This glory is described in the following verses. And note the symmetry and beauty of verses 10 and 11. Steadfast love and faithfulness will meet. Righteousness and peace will kiss each other. Faithfulness will spring up from the ground, and righteousness will look down from the sky. Steadfast love and faithfulness will meet. Righteousness and peace will kiss each other. Faithfulness will spring up from the ground, and righteousness will look down from the sky. Steadfast love and faithfulness are naturally paired, just as righteousness and peace are naturally paired together. Edwin Petit writes, "Faithfulness is the core of all virtue, that incorruptible, staunch, and fearless integrity. Steadfast love is that quality which keeps integrity aware of the need to restore that which is disintegrated. If faithfulness is the core of all virtue, peace is at the heart of all felicity," that is, great happiness. "And righteousness is its only needed credential." In other words, righteousness is what proves faithfulness and peace. End of quote. When these things occur properly and are in balance, perfect balance might be found in life and in relationships with God and even those around us. Those who really prove trust in God will be granted God's peace and God's salvation. Now that's a promise. That's a promise. Yet, while some correctly speak of God's steadfastness and faithfulness, the love and faithfulness of persons helps to complete the purposes of God, the desires of God for the world as a whole and for you and me individually and for us collectively as people of God. In verse 11, faithfulness will spring up from the ground and righteousness will look down from the sky. Now, we often see earth and sky or heaven as antithetical. But the primary point here is that when the Lord's salvation comes, there will be perfect harmony between the terrestrial, the earthly, and the celestial, the heavenly worlds. As Stuart McCullough writes, "The divine attributes found in verse 10 will have become the common virtues of all of humanity." Verse 11. I'm going to digress for a moment here. I know that surprises you. But it reminds me of, once again, of something I mentioned a number of times, Philo of Alexandria, Egypt, that great Jewish philosopher who sought to blend the best of Greek philosophy and the best of Hebrew theology. And in looking at the earth and the heavens and all the worlds that God had made, the Greek philosophers talked about different spheres. And there was the idea that when everything was in proper alignment, all the spheres of the universe, Philo writes, that when that happens, one can hear the music of the spheres, speaking of harmony and peace. And you all, if you're a music person or you remember what I have said before in times past, we still sing of that. This is my Father's world, and to my listening ears, all nature sings and round me rings the music of the spheres. Speaking of the harmony in God's world, that's Philo of Alexandria, and that's good Jewish theology. And it's good Christian theology. That there is that harmony when this relationship is proper. Now that might sound like a pipe dream and something unattainable until the end of history. Yet while we as humans cannot achieve such a wondrous thing, the possibility still exists. And it's a goal toward which we are to work unceasingly. That's not my alarm clock, it's somebody else's. Our confidence might sometimes become shaky in all of this, but the psalmist reminds us that God will give what is good and what is needed. The imagery in verse 13 is one of power and beauty and confident hope. The psalmist knows the shortcomings and the sins of the people, but he remains confident of better days in our lives. Why? Why should he have confidence in this kind of situation? Because he knows the promises of God supersede even our own actions, and that ultimately our fortunes are derived from our relationship to God through moral imperatives. Integrity, gentleness, goodness, and self-control. All promises of God for you and me, if we will but live them. Wow, just think, I can count on God's promises. That's so awesome, isn't it? Yes, it is. But does it mean more than just reaping the benefits? Absolutely. So then, what does that actually mean? Maybe we're hearing the music of the spheres. That's okay. I think it sounds kind of nice. Just little tinkling bells. An angel just got his wings. Oh, no. So what does it mean? We need to take God at His word by living as if we actually believe His promises. You know, some people claim the promises of God, and then a lot of people claim the promises of God, and we don't live like we believe them. That means confidence, even in times of sadness and despair. It means walking along with God when others around us sneer at Christians. It means we live as persons who make promises and then keep them. As one writer posits, Scott Claybrook, and I quote, "The very notion of a promise is becoming increasingly foreign in our culture. The idea that you would want to limit yourself to one person through marriage seems preposterous to so many. The suggestion that you will do something for someone, even when it means your best interest is not the end result, is considered ridiculous. By making and keeping promises, the church today has the ability to both embody and proclaim the gospel, the good news of a God who makes and keeps His promises." End of quote. We as church have something to say about being community, because community is promises made and promises kept. That's community. Those we make and those made to us. But our promises are valid and substantive only because of the promises made by God, who has promised first and foremost to be with us even to the end of the age. And you know something? That's a promise on which you can count, that God will be with you even to the end of the age. So promises, God's made his. What's mine? Our closing hymn is hymn number 410. Standing on the promises, far too many people stand on them, but then sit on the premises. As we sing, may we not only think about standing on the promises of God, but also our responsibility to move forward, carrying forth with those promises. Hymn number 410, Standing on the Promises.